Live from the Findlay Toyota Studios, it's Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
All right, here we go on this Tuesday, following up a Monday Night Football game. Willie's here, Griffin is here. Lots to get to. We'll talk to Raiders expert Jesse Merrick from Silver and Black Sports Network in the 4 o'clock hour. Lots to get to, but it ain't going to be all happy. Because that was a weird game last night. It was a weird fourth quarter. Chargers win, Raiders lose. Willie, you were in the building. What was the fourth quarter like? As the Raiders just spit the bit on opportunity after opportunity, what was the crowd like?
The crowd actually wasn't that bad. They stayed into it. Surprisingly, I didn't really hear the boo birds, which you would have expected. But here's the thing. As weird as it may have looked, I think the strangest thing was because the Chargers couldn't pull away. But the Raiders' offense looked as awful as it looked like in the fourth, where you're sitting there going, what is going on? It was like that the entire night. I was keeping notes for whatever side. I was right in the losing side. My colleague was right in the winning side. So I'm sitting there keeping notes purposely on the Raiders as I'm watching this go. And it never stopped with the offense. So for me, it wasn't necessarily the fourth quarter, because what I was watching and preparing to write about was the offense, and it looked the same the entire game. It just, the score was not indicative of how it went. The defense actually stepped up in the second half.
I thought we should probably just talk about the defense for a half an hour, because I feel like we're gonna have this.
Otherwise, we're gonna be ripping them.
Oh, what's gonna send? Yeah, it's gonna we're slanted, and that we're just annihilating the Raiders, but the D actually did a really good job outside of the 60-yarder to Quentin Johnston, but they kept everything underneath. They bottled up the run game. They did a really good job. It was a lot of dink and dunk, but the offense couldn't maintain possession. And then when it did, I'm sorry, I've never seen anything like, I understand being kind of patient when you're only down two touchdowns in the middle of the third quarter, but the drive they executed that took 12 minutes and 19 plays?
Right.
Like, where was the urgency? And then the best part is it's 20-6, and you kick a field goal to go 14.
Yeah.
Down to 11. I'm like, I don't get what's happening here.
You have to go for it, because regardless, you're going to eventually need a touchdown anyway. So the field goal didn't do you any good. I'm not sure what he was worried about, what he was scared about. A lot of us were questioning and wondering why Ashton Jeanty, out of nowhere, there was a point in time where he was the most consistent part of the offense, meaning every time he touched the ball, even if he wasn't gaining substantial yards, he was running with authority. He was running with confidence, right? Like last week, I think it was 18, 19 attempts, 38 yards. It took him 9 attempts, I believe, to get to 39 yards last night. But there was that 3rd-and-1, and they decide to use Zamir White, and they get stopped for minus 2 yards. And then Ashton Jeanty doesn't even get in the next series. So everybody's tweeting about it. I'm asking about it. I actually talked to someone with the Raiders. Was just BSing in the press room. He goes, everybody's making a big deal. I don't understand. This is not abnormal. This is normal stuff where, like, he can't just play. I was like, you're making it sound as if he needs a breather. He needs a rest. This kid played, I mean, go look at his participation percentage in terms of, you know, I mean, I get it. College to NFL is a lot different, but nevertheless, it's not like he doesn't have the conditioning or stamina. And when he's the biggest part of the, you know, the most consistent part of the offense at this point, Geno Smith is struggling, that kid should be in there. And if you want to give him a couple of downs off, I get it. But on that 3rd-and-1, he should have been in the game, in my opinion. But I'm not the coach. But as it is, Pete Carroll afterwards explained to us that, oh, it's coming. He's a work in progress, but we're not going to rush him along. He's a rookie. So,
well, then how about run someone else?
Well, they tried. It's just nothing worked.
Yeah. So the run game's a big problem right now. And then at quarterback, we had a lot of people who love Geno Smith, especially from outside the market, who swore by his accuracy. I didn't think he was very accurate last night. He missed on some bad passes. Obviously, he threw three interceptions. I really disliked, and I know this is probably an overreaction. You're still in the game. You throw an interception, and then they have him on the sidelines, on the bench, just mad-dogging, just looking pouty. There's 5.5 minutes left. You can't.
He was down,
as the quarter. Well, then someone's got to go over and go, come on, man, stand up, talk to the offensive player. You're supposed to be the leader. You're not supposed to be brooding by yourself.
Right. Yeah, no.
So it was a bad look offensively. I don't understand the game they called from the middle of the third quarter on. The O-line without Jackson Powers, Johnson didn't look good. I'll give you the other one, a small detail, but it's hard to keep Ashton Jeanty in on third down if he can't block. And he had one play where he got sucked over to a blocking assignment where someone already had someone covered, and then Khalil Mack just whipped right through the gap, and then Jeanty kind of threw his shoulder into him, but Khalil Mack's like, get the hell out of the way.
Yeah.
You got to be able to block, too. You got to get your blocking assignments going.
He also went
not a great game for Jeanty, not a great game for Geno Smith.
He also went the wrong direction on a play. Geno Smith went one way. He went the other. It was supposed to go the same. So that part I get. I just think that there was a little bit of momentum in Jeanty's favor. And he should. And I just felt on that third one, it was a critical third one. You put your star running back. He's your star, rookie or not. Nevertheless, the other thing that I asked Pete Carroll about this is how much he was worried about and did it affect the play calling. Brock Bowers was questionable going into the game, and then he was not necessarily game time decision, but it was announced at whatever point that he was going to play, he was available. And he said it was something that we were worried about. We were thinking about that knee and how could he go. He said, and we started using him more in the second half. We started going to him more. Nevertheless, it's a little bit of a difference when you're like, well, do we go to him? Do we overuse him? Do we, you know, and that could alter some change. Not that that was the biggest reason, but it could alter your thinking. So there was a lot going on, and it's not to make excuses because the offense was putrid. And a week after you had an air show go on in New England and you looked incredible with the passing game, and it made up for a horrible rushing game. As it is right now through the first 2 weeks, the Raiders have the second worst rushing attack, 124 yards. I believe the Bengals are the only one that don't have 100 yards rushing through two games. So that was a problem that needed to be addressed during the offseason. You know, we talked about that in terms of, you know, the rushing game. Pete Carroll knew it coming in. It was very weak last year. It needs to, you know, and I asked Geno Smith in the postgame presser, how important is that rushing game? Balance is one thing. We know that, right? A balanced offense is obviously, I mean, it's an obvious answer when you say how important is a balanced offense, rushing and passing. But for Geno, how important is it to have at least a complementary rushing game? You don't even have that. You know, to take some pressure off, to know that, you know, you're not going to be frustrated. Because I talked about that through training camp. You asked me, everybody asked, what do you think? I said, I thought Ashton Jeanty being pro ready, the way that we've seen him in practice and in preseason, it was going to take some pressure off. As it is for the first two games, I was wrong because he doesn't look pro ready.
Can we go glass half full talking about the defense?
Absolutely. Because I think that the defense is doing a phenomenal job in making adjustments. Now, the secondary that everyone was concerned about had some breakdowns last night. There was one big play, obviously, resulted in a touchdown. But other than that, it made the right adjustments. A lot of people were getting on Max Crosby because they didn't hear his name being called.
Oh, my God.
Much. But
get on Max Crosby. Were you watching? He had an incredible game.
Had a wonderful game. And
he
even
disrupted everything on almost every freaking play he was in or to set up someone else.
And the thing, well, I was just going to say, the other thing is, if he's drawing double teams, it's opening something up. Whether he's a distraction or he's loading up the stat sheet for himself, he's an impact player. He caused that fumble, which Pete Carroll said he probably didn't get credit for a forced fumble. I think he said that he looked at it and turned something in to get a stat officially turned over. There's something he should get.
He was close enough, and it was a mishandled handoff, but yes. He's the one who finalized it. His get-off, I mean, I think Trey Pipkins is a weak right tackle, but his get-off was just insane.
His impact just being there is.
And I thought the back end did a good job. Only 317 total yards for the Chargers. Frankly, the Chargers, for a while there, were kind of telling the Raiders defense, we don't believe in you at all. We're just going to punk you and go for it on fourth down. I mean, they're going for it on fourth down, midfield. I thought the D played pretty well. But at some point, the offense has got to deliver, and that's a game they could have won. I'll say even, you know, losing 20-9 and down, you know, kind of comfortably in the favor of the Chargers, or up comfortably in the favor of the Chargers for most of the game, the Chargers left the door open. The Raiders could have won that game.
I want to reiterate. I don't want to make it seem like nobody said that. The buzz wasn't that Max Crosby had a bad game. Okay. It was that we didn't hear his name. Like, it wasn't as dominating. But the thing is, he doesn't have to fill up the stat sheet to be dominant.
Yeah.
If he's drawing double and triple teams, it means he's causing disruption on the offensive line in having to pull two and three people to cover him. It's opening things up at the other end. Or
I will
in the
tell
middle.
You, on the TV broadcast, I know you were in the stadium. I was not. On the TV broadcast, they so fixated on Justin Herbert being Jesus in cleats at quarterback, and then when they had a chance to talk about the defense, it was a lot about Derwin James, but it was a lot about Max Crosby and how incredible he is. So he got his name called on TV, and in the case of Orlovsky and Lou Riddick, they did a really nice job on, you know, focusing on the fact that it was a very disruptive effort by Crosby. He wasn't finishing with sacks. He might not necessarily be getting tackles, but he was at times ruining everything that the Chargers wanted to do. And let's also say that while the back end, and this is why Crosby's awesome, right, and why that D-line, if it's going to be really good, helps out the back end, I think the Chargers started to realize that they had the dink and dunk stuff underneath, but they absolutely did not have it deep. Whether it was coverage, I think a lot of it was because they had to get rid of the ball. Otherwise, Justin Herbert was going to be running for his life. So there's some things to build on.
Yeah.
But,
well, let's give one shout-out real quick,
and,
Steve.
And I'll mention one last thing. In defense of Geno and Genty, maybe the Chargers defense is, again, a top five defense. Last year, yardage-wise, they were top five.
It is.
And you gave me a look, but they were last year.
No, so their defense is elite, but at the same token, you're supposed to turn that offense around. And coming off what you did last week, it shouldn't have played that bad, even if as Chargers were. But I will give one shout-out before I break. Local, Jonah Laulu, tremendous game. Tremendous game. Four tackles, three solo, two sacks. Loss of 6 yards, three quarterback hurries, three tackles for loss. Centennial grad does great.
It's Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
Cofield and Company, Willie's here. It's Cofield. We'll continue to recap the Raiders game. The other big story that came out of last night, actually it turned out to be the lead story because the game was such a weird game and such an odd fourth quarter, was Boothgate. Headset gate. Boothgate. Brady Boothgate. Say that fast five times, right? Brady Boothgate.
Sounds like a Sherlock Holmes.
When you're at the game like you are, you're up in the press box, do you have any idea what's going on with that whole thing and what's unfolding on TV?
No, we saw him up there. I saw him walk by while we were all eating. Of course, everybody's eyes go, oh my, there. And I didn't know where he was headed. I didn't even know that he was going there. And then the tweets started.
Yep.
And then we see everything. And it ended up being the lead to my story.
Oh, now, it was? Okay.
Now, I write about the losing side. But the lead was because, obviously, with SEOs and clicks and made sense to put him in there. It was basically, you know, hours after a big announcement, he's up in the booth with headset on. Didn't matter. Raiders offense looked muddled, and then it went right into it. So I used it as a lead, but then as my closer. But, yeah, it was the storyline. And I think our own Adam Hill from the company did a follow-up this morning about it. So it's certainly the talk that came out of the game. Maybe that's a good thing because instead of focusing on how bad the offense was and the Raiders themselves in that performance, the story that came out of last night from the Raiders' perspective is Tom Brady in the booth.
Well, it became a big story because as ESPN was doing the game, they said Brady and Chip Kelly talk 2 to 3 times a week. And they just kind of left it open-ended, and everyone's like, wait, are they talking strategy? Are they talking football? I thought that wasn't really supposed to happen. Again, he has a TV job where he's now allowed to meet with in that – you know, prep day, he's allowed to meet with coaches and the teams of the games he's covering. Well, coming up, there's a clear conflict of interest, at least for people who are like, hey, how closely tied is this owner of the Raiders to the Raiders coaching staff? Because Brady's going to work the Cowboys and Bears game this week, and the Raiders play the Bears here in 2 weeks. Now, do I think Brady is going to mine the Bears staff for information and then pass it on to the Raiders staff? No. But guess what?
It's the look.
The look of the impropriety, the possible violation. I don't think the NFL is going to do anything about it, but they're going to have to cover this up pretty quickly because it's a bad look. Although, what I guess by the rules, what? It's not against the rules for an owner to have a headset on up in the box, right?
That's it. That's what, I mean, the statement, there are no policies that prohibit an owner from sitting in the coach's booth or wearing a headset during a game. Brady was sitting in the booth in his capacity as a limited partner. All personnel sitting in the booth must abide by policies that prohibit the use of electronic devices other than league-issued equipment, such as Microsoft Surface tablet, for the sideline viewing system. So that was the statement. The league said in a statement that was obtained by Pellicero. So that's on the NFL.com website. That's their story. So he didn't do anything wrong. It's not necessary. Here's the thing. It's not necessarily about him being in the booth. It's about him being a commentator on Fox.
Right.
So that has nothing to do. Let's kind of shy away from the owner and what he can do. It's about what the owner and the tie-in with being a commentator and that tie-in. And then, like you said, this weekend, he's calling the Bears Cowboys, and then in 2 weeks, the Bears come here.
Now, and honestly, if I'm Ben Johnson, I probably will raise a stink and be like, I'm sorry, I don't want him in these meetings. I'm not. Or I'm just not going to say a whole lot. Sorry, guys. Or, you know, I guess Tom can recuse himself. Well, I can say the word recuse.
Yeah.
From the discussion. From the case.
Well, the thing is Ben Johnson could just say, I'm not going to involve myself. Because if he says, I'll go, but Tom can't, well, Tom's still got to partners. So they're going to share it with him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's himself. It's he has to recuse himself if he wants to raise a stink about it.
Sign up today for the new William Hill Nevada Mobile Sports account. You can earn up to a $250 bonus bet after placing your first qualifying wager. The app allows you to bet on the go from anywhere in the state of Nevada, the Android, the iPad, the iPhone. Sign up today. You never miss another bet. Got a great, voluminous wagering menu. The William Hill Mobile Sports app features same game parlays, live in play, and early cash out. $250 bonus bet going on right now up to when you sign up for a brand new William Hill Nevada Mobile Sports account. For more information, visit williamhill.us.
Now back to Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
So we talked about Raiders' performance last night. I didn't think the coaching in the game was great. Patrick Graham, defense, I thought they had a pretty good game since the 60-yard reception by Quentin Johnston, who we were kind of speaking cryptically yesterday or in code. When Adam Hill was on, Adam and I were mentioning Quentin Johnston. I was talking about his hands, and Adam and I had a good argument back to the draft that Johnston came out where the Chargers took Quentin Johnston in Flowers with the Ravens. And Zay Flowers has been much more productive. And Johnston, he got better last year, but he was one of the big reasons that there were a lot of drops for Justin Herbert. And he's gotten better, and he's obviously a deep threat, and Herbert likes him. Man, I got so much more on the Raiders, but we'll get to it. So I don't know that I could give Chip Kelly and Pete Carroll more than a C for yesterday. There were some other coaching jobs week two that I don't understand. The Colts won. And so I want to give credit to Shane Steichen for appearing to have begun the resurrection of Danny Dimes, Daniel Jones, which I did call for. I am the only person in the country who said that the Colts could win the division against the Texans. I know that's not the case. But Steichen down the stretch, I hate this about the NFL. I hate it about college. I'm trying to think of who did this a couple weeks ago. Oh, it was actually, you know, when it works, no one says anything. But Mario Cristobal in that Miami-Notre Dame game basically played for, I think it was a 47-yard field goal with a college kicker, which to me is insanity. And the Colts had the ball with a decent amount of time left. They're trying to run down the clock. And they run the ball three straight times with Johnny Taylor, and in essence, settling for a 60-yard field goal. Win or lose, that's it. And then they get the break of the leverage play, which, by the way, as a former college football defensive lineman, I'm guessing you weren't inside very often. But how infuriating. Were you inside sometimes?
On special teams? Special teams. Yeah. Oh, okay. I thought you meant inside, like playing D-tackle or three-tech. Yeah. Special teams, which unit? Punt, field goal?
Well, field goal. So field goal block, where you're not allowed to jump in front of the center, NFL. Ooh, but yeah. You're not allowed to jump in front of the center. I would think, like, it's just human nature that you're like, I'm going to freaking jump. I want to leap over this person. Well, the Broncos do it. You know, by the letter of the law, it is the rule. And a missed field goal turns into an easier attempt, and I think they nailed it. Again, it was like a 47-yarder or 45-yarder, and they win the game. But not due to Shane Steichen's game management down the stretch. I don't get it. When there's one guy I will accept. Maybe there's two. But I know on the home front I won't be accepted. Cameron Dicker is ridiculous. But if you want to play for – nah, I'm not going to say it. You can't play for 60 yards. The one guy is probably Brandon Aubrey, but still, you got to try to, like, that's the thing you keep in your back pocket. You're like, oh, okay, if we just freaking just bumble this set of downs and we don't get any yards to get closer, then we got Aubrey. But you can't play for it. You can't play for a 60-yarder, and they got bailed out.
You really can't play for that. You got to, even if you have a world, one of the best kickers in the entire world, you still have to play as a coach. Your mindset, especially on a drive, if it's the last 2 minutes or it's a drive that's going to decide the game, you really have to give absolutely no room for there to be some mishap with the kicking team, with the field goal. You got to get as close as possible. And even if you have all the faith in the world of your kicker, you should still have the mindset of, let's get this, whatever this guy's range is, if it's 40 yards, yeah, if it's 50, let's get it to 20.
There isn't such a thing as close enough.
Exactly.
That being said, the Colts could move to 3-0.
They are unbeaten.
They play Tennessee. They look to Indianapolis looks to start 3-0 for the first time since 2009. In the first 2 weeks, Colts became the first team in NFL history to score on each of their first 10 offensive possessions of a season. First team in the Super Bowl era to not punt in either of their first two games in a season.
That's impressive.
Daniel Jones is one of four players in NFL history with at least 270 passing yards, a touchdown pass, and a rushing touchdown in each of his team's first two games of a season. The other three are Jack Kemp, Kyler Murray, and Cam Newton.
Okay, how about this coaching job? Because I love coaches that go for it on fourth down. In fact, I was calling out John Harbaugh. He's got to change his mind. Or change his tune against the best quarterbacks in the league. You got to go for it on fourth down often. You can't give the ball back to the enemy, especially when the enemy is Mahomes or Josh Allen. Liam Cohen. The Jaguars are up 27-24. There was, just over 4 minutes left. They've got the ball at the Cincy 7 on a 4th and 5. You're up 3, 27-24. You have a chance to go up 30-24. He goes for it on fourth down. Now, I guess the logic is, and I was watching the game. I heard the announcer say, like, hey, if they don't get it, they're going to have to drive whatever it is, like 88 yards to get it. Well, in this case, actually all it had to be was a game-tying field goal. What do you think about going for it on 4th and 5 at the other team's 7 when you have a chance to push it to 6? A lot of people were getting on Liam Cohen. I'm sure analytics people are like, well, it might have been a slight percentage, in terms of better chance of winning.
You're up by 3.
Yeah.
And you're 7 yards out.
Yes. 4th and 5, though. You have a chance to kick a field goal to go 30-24.
I mean,
you go for it on 4th and 5?
I don't have a problem with that.
Really?
I don't have a problem going for 4th and 5 because if you kick the field goal and you're up by 6,
they still have to
drive down there.
And they did. They eventually did.
So one way or the other, they were still driving down there and doing it.
Yeah. It was interesting. Liam Cohen, I think it's one of those heat of the moment deals in a game. Liam Cohen and Trevor Lawrence kind of got into it where Cohen was kind of going crazy, gesturing. And then you just see Trevor Lawrence go and wave him off. So I'm sure they talked about it after the game. Liam Cohen seems like a lunatic, with the Duval, however he did it. He's a weird guy.
Yeah, super weird guy.
Okay, this one's a kind of a joke. But does Sean McVay have to kind of – well, now he does. Does Sean McVay have to kind of rethink who he is and what he can do on the field at 39 years old? Because, you know, he used to be the boy genius, as I dubbed him, only person in the country to say that. The boy genius is now 39, Willie. And he tore the plantar fascia. So I assume that maybe he had some issues before this. I think sometimes tearing it is actually the, like, it's going to suck because you're going to probably be in a walking boot for a while and you got to be careful, but tearing it is actually the way to lead to recovery at some point. But he tore the plantar fascia during the game. Painful. Not the boy genius anymore.
Painful.
Ah, 40! Genius. Even though he's only 39. I just wanted to yell that.
You put this in the category of
worst coaching move of the week. I mean, he managed the Rams okay, but he didn't manage yourself.
I think he gets a pass.
Fluke injury? He's got to know his body a little better. How old's his wife? Maybe he thinks he's got like the fountain of youth because the wife's a lot younger.
They got a big game at 2-0 Rams against the 2-0 Eagles. You realize 10 teams have started the season 2-0 with at least one undefeated team in each division for the third time since 2002.
NFL sucks. No balance.
Four teams, Arizona, Cincinnati, Indianapolis, and Frisco, missed the postseason last year. For the second consecutive season, at least four teams started 2-0 after missing the playoffs the year before. The Rams and Eagles, little rematch. They met last year in the playoffs.
All right, you went in this direction. Who's the worst 2-0 team and will not make the playoffs? Ready? Bills, Bills, yes or no playoffs?
Yes.
Bengals, yes or no playoffs?
Yes. Oh, no.
Keep that in mind. Will they have the worst record at the end of the year? Colts, 2-0. Playoffs?
Colts will make the playoffs. I like what they're doing.
Chargers, 2-0.
Yes.
Okay, so you went 3 or 4 there. Eagles, 2-0?
Yes.
Packers, 2-0?
Yes.
Bucks, 2-0?
Oof.
I mean, they've won the division 4 years in a row. They're not going to make the playoffs now?
Yeah, they're scrappy.
Okay. And then three teams in the NFC West. Niners playoffs?
Yes.
I say no. Cardinals 2-0. Playoffs?
No.
Rams 2-0. Playoffs?
Yes.
Okay, so you said no for two of them. So who's worse, the Cardinals or the Bengals at the end of the year?
Bengals, I think, because I think they're going to have problems without Joe Burrow.
Yeah, much like my fantasy team, the Bengals are screwed without Joe Burrow.
I get two dinners. You're still getting one, right? That's where we are in our bet payoff. I have two owed to me.
Yeah.
I owe you one.
Yes, yes.
Do we have a bet here?
That.
Better record. Cardinals or Bengals? I'll take the Bengals.
Okay. I'll go with that.
Okay.
Big Jake Browning guy over here, huh? That much faith in the backup QB?
I am a Jake Browning guy.
Okay. No,
although I've also pointed out, though, that I do believe the Bengals have a recipe for disaster. If things start going south, I really do believe Zach Taylor is about as weak in terms of strength as a coach and respect. I also think that's why they've gotten off to horrible starts. And I think Mike Brown set up the team for potentially some, hey, let's bail on the season. But they're out of the gates. Well, so yes, I am a Jake Browning guy. And you know, no one loves Kyler Murray more than me. Mm-hmm. I love little Kyler. But
you're the only person in the country I know something.
Well, I'm the only person in Las Vegas who constantly said last season and during the offseason that I wanted him to be the franchise guy, go trade for him with the Raiders.
You've reduced it. Because we are 39 minutes in, and you've already had two or three. I'm the only guy in the country. And now it's the only guy in
Las
Vegas.
That's what we're doing now. Oh. That's what we do. We pat ourselves on the back. This is self-promotion.
Don't dislocate your shoulder.
I'm not holding back anymore. I'm going to be quite braggadocious.
How about this?
Okay, so you got
another 2-0
official bet.
Buccaneers are the first team since the 1970 merger to score a game-winning touchdown in the final minute of each of their first two games of a season.
I saw that. That's pretty crazy. Baker Magic. Let's make a bet. No, I'm kidding. I don't even know how we judge it. Most fourth-quarter comebacks this year. I'm already in the lead with Baker. All right, so
well,
we
you're the only guy in the country that said that he would do that.
Okay, I got some more Buccaneer stuff coming up.
Okay.
I actually think they have more than fair shot to win the NFC. So we'll get to that. On the way, though, let's have a little more recap of the fight. Steve Kim was on yesterday. Steve is wonderful. Okay. Let's talk to a guy who like really, and Steve knows the sport, but like really knows the ins and outs. Mm. A longtime trainer and boxing coach here in the market. He was the ringside reporter. Skipper Kelp. Skipper's coming up with Willie and Cofield.
Now back to Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
Still a lot to talk about with the big fight over the weekend. I want to see a rematch. I think there were intriguing things in the fight. Other people are like, don't need to see it again. I want Vegas to get a rematch for the money, for the tourism, all of that. And I hope Canelo wants a rematch. I hope. Let's bring in Skipper Kelp, who if you didn't know, well, then you're probably not here from Vegas, because Skipper's been a long time, I'll call him a character, but a former professional boxer, but a dude on the Vegas boxing scene, of course, connected to UNLV boxing, and Skipper's up with Cofield and Willie. How are you, sir?
Hey, guys. Steve, how are you? It's a pleasure to here, and I like character. I never heard that one before, but I like it.
That's a good one. You were a character when you were doing the judging on the fight. You know, I stayed around the fight watching on TV for probably about 10 minutes after the fight. I don't know. I guess at some point they must have put up your final card. What was your final card? Because you had Crawford really from the get-go outpacing Canelo pretty seriously.
Yeah, Crawford, he didn't pitch a shutout, but he won most of the rounds. I honestly can't remember what my final score was. I think I was like 9-3 or something like that for Crawford. There were some close rounds. And close rounds, but I think even the close rounds, Crawford did just enough, the significant strikes to pull those off. I don't think the fight was in question at all, but it was a fun fight. And I think a lot of people were surprised to see Canelo beat as soundly as he was beat, if you thought so.
Yeah, I had it, I believe it was 118-11, is that what the breakdown,
yeah,
or 18-10, or I think I had a 10-2. So it was those close rounds that other people, I think people were inclined to, if you're watching it, or even the judges that had it, a tie going into the championship rounds, in my opinion. I don't know what they were watching, but I think it's one of those things where, Skipper, where you're watching it and it's so close, and it's one of those ones where you look up and you wish you had 50 seconds instead of 10, because you don't know who you're going to give the round to, and we've all been there, and you automatically want to give it to Canelo. Where I was looking at it going, he's not hitting him. If anything, Crawford's blocking these shots. They're not significant enough. And the one or two that Crawford are landing, they're knocking his head backward.
Significant, and in bunches, not just one or two. They came in threes and fours sometimes.
What did Crawford do that was so masterful in terms of game plan?
Well, one thing, once he downloaded the data, and in the process, in the beginning, Crawford is known for starting slow. Canelo is actually a slow starter as well, but Crawford is really known for starting slow, and he downloads the data. Mm-hmm. But against Canelo, he has to win these rounds, because giving up early rounds against Canelo is not good, because judges seem to favor Canelo. His heavy punches, they seem to get the judges' attention. So Crawford did a great job of winning these early rounds while he was downloading data. And then once he downloaded the data, it was a wrap to me. He did a great job of maintaining the distance. And when he threw his punches, you watch, he kept circling out to the left or to the right. And that forced Canelo to chase him and reset every time. And once Crawford had that data downloaded, you could see he was fluid. He was letting his punches go. I've never seen, you could say with Floyd, but Floyd was in and out a lot. I've never seen a fighter so comfortable in the fire zone with Canelo than with Crawford. Crawford was so comfortable there. He blocked his shots. He was very disciplined, because prior to this fight, I've seen Crawford be willing to get hit with shots. He knew against Canelo he couldn't be willing to get hit with those shots he normally gets hit with. So his defense was on point. His hand was right up above his ear, and he was just very disciplined, and he knew the assignment. Throw your punches, circle out, frustrate him. Then when he's frustrated, swing it wide, get inside and pick him apart. It was masterful. It was a great performance.
Skipper Kelp on ESPN Las Vegas. He was a ringside judge on Netflix for Canelo and Crawford on Saturday. Did you like Canelo's game plan?
You know, I think his game plan was to attack and put pressure on Crawford. So the game plan, yes, that's what he had to do. Now you have to execute it, and you're executing a game plan against a guy with a very high IQ that just out-executed you. You know, so yeah, his game plan wasn't wrong. You just got to execute it.
If they have a rematch, can Canelo make that a fight that's more in the phone booth or not in the middle of the ring, get him on the ropes and trap him in the corner? Is that possible with Crawford?
Oh, man, I think no. And at this point, no, I don't think so. You know, it's maybe a young, hungry Canelo that's not sleeping in satin sheets. But Canelo now, he just pocketed $150 million. Yeah. Those days are done. You know, there's a point in time in the fight game that you got to hang the gloves up because father time takes your motivation, your skill. There's a lot of things. And Canelo's a legend. There's no knock here. It's just father time has crept up to you.
You talked about Crawford and somewhat comparing him to Mayweather, but I think the difference between Crawford and guys like that are the power, right? And the guy I thought of in the fight I thought of actually was Sweet Pea. I mean, Pernell Whitaker was brilliant. He was one of the smartest fighters that you could watch, and I still to this day say he got robbed against De La Hoya. But in the same capacity where this was a guy who he could dance and move, but at the same time, he wasn't afraid to stand there. And the thing that Crawford, I thought, that he did well, Skipper, was he didn't go move backwards away from punches. He slipped. So dropping his head, moving forward, coming right back, and countering, his slips were phenomenal, and I don't think you see that enough these days.
He fought a disciplined fight. Someone like Canelo going straight back, that's what he wants because he's going to take you straight back, put you on the ropes, and do his work. He circled him. He circled out. He was very methodical and so technically sound in this fight. And he knew the assignment. He knew what he had to do. And you could tell he worked his game plan to the T. It was beautiful.
Once again, speaking with Skipper Kelp, ringside judge for Netflix during the Canelo-Crawford match. So let's talk about Crawford's place in history at this point. I mean, I spoke to him last week during a one-on-one, I asked him, what is Terrence Crawford's legacy pre- and post-fight? And he said, pre-fight, I'm Hall of Famer. End of story. Post-fight, it's the biggest fight of my career. Where does he sit, in your eyes, in the history of boxing?
Man, you can argue him on Mount Rushmore. You know, and it's when you get to this level, it's so opinionated because there are a handful of guys that belong here. But he's one of them. He's absolutely one of them now.
Skipper Kelp is
with
us.
He goes along. Yeah, he's a – yeah, it's hard to argue him not being on Mount Rushmore.
Let's go back to Canelo for a second. You were kind of leaning towards, hey, maybe he just doesn't have it. Maybe he doesn't have the motivation anymore. He's, 34 and three quarters. Are you suggesting that he just walk away? Or, I mean, he's got two more fights on this contract, and I'm sure he's going to get at least 100 mil per fight. So should he walk away?
You know, when it's a slippery slope saying he doesn't have it no more because he fought now one of the greatest fighters of all time. Mm-hmm. And Canelo's an all-time great. He's a legend, first ballot Hall of Famer. So to say that he's diminished that much is unfair. It's just at that level, this was the absolute highest level opponent. It turns out now that Crawford could be the best guy Canelo ever fought, you know? So I don't want to denigrate him and say father time has completely gotten to him, but at this level, yeah. And what's his motivation now? What's going to motivate Canelo? Like who would he fight that would get him to wake up and go train? You know, it's not going to be, he doesn't want to fight Bivol. Why would he fight Bivol? Move up again, not Benavidez. You know, could he get motivated to fight Crawford? I don't know. You know, the money talks, but at some point you got enough money to do whatever you want to do. You know, he's got two more fights on the deal apparently with Turki Alashik, but I don't know what the motivation is. Is it going to be two fights that kind of like sent him off, get two wins under his belt, or, you know, will Turki want him to fight someone significant with that kind of money? I don't know. I just think it'd be hard for him to get motivated now.
Is there 160
to that level?
Is there a 160 pounder, a true middleweight that you'd want to see Crawford fight? Because I think he has the interest in going there and getting those belts.
You know what? That's the thing. Everyone's asked me. So you look back on history, right? So Roy Jones, in my opinion, in his prime. So there's a new term that I got, and it's not pound for pound. It's prime for prime. Mm. Prime for prime, Roy Jones is the best fighter of all times, in my opinion. Prime for prime. So now imagine if Roy Jones retires after he fights John Ruiz. It would be so hard to argue that he's not the greatest of all times. So if Crawford takes a step back and evaluates the landscape of boxing and look at Roy Jones as a model, would he not want to say, you know what, I just did something no one has ever done before. they can, you can't argue. I'm always in the argument for pound the best. Now I moved up and walk away. Learn from Roy Jones. If he did that, you can't say anything. Now I do see this. Crawford wanting to move down to get the middleweight title because he passed that up, and now he would add another weight class to his resume, and that would be something I could see him getting motivated by. But it's a slippery slope. You know, when Roy went up and went back down, he was never quite the same. I don't know if that would happen with Crawford because it wasn't that extreme going up to heavyweight and back down to light heavyweight, and there's not that stylistic nightmare of an opponent in Antonio Tarver. You know, so I think if Crawford could find a middleweight champion, I don't think there's any killers right now, and he can see his way to get that title, I think he'd be motivated enough to show up for that fight and then call it a day.
Skipper, great job on the fight. Great job on this spot. Let's get you on more often. I appreciate the time.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. Have a great night.
There he is, Skipper Kelp. Had the fight pretty accurately one-sided with Crawford, and here's the problem for Terrence Crawford, because boxing has done a lousy job of promoting guys. When you look at 160, you're like, okay, who's the guy? Like, who's going to get people all fired up so that Crawford can make, you know, tens of millions of dollars now that he's in the position of power?